It will eventually end up in the Pacific University TIA archives. Let's see here. Let's do it like that. So one microphone is pointed at you and one at me. And I got to tell you, this is the easiest place to get to from Forest Grove in all of Salem. Just go until you see civilization and turn.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. Wonderful.
Okay. Yeah, I'm...
Who did you get selected for this task?
Vic chose me.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. Did you come up to the university when we opened up his archive?
No, I did not.
So
I contributed to it, but there's something that came up that day.
Probably a doctor.
Yeah, a doctor appointment or some other.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Just
get
didn't
to the
make
age
it.
Where
so I missed my last chance, actually, to
yeah.
see Victor.
And that's it. It had the feeling of a valedictory gathering.
Do you want some water, honey?
Yeah,
juice
water. Or hey, how about apple juice?
Apple juice?
Please.
But about when we met him about 2 weeks after that, that's when he told me he decided he wanted me to write the biography.
Good.
So I was able to interview him four times, recorded before he died. And then, get started on this thing.
Things have changed dramatically over the years. I can, for example, recording. It's not that I feel totally inhibited, but I feel that I have to be careful about what I say. Whereas nowadays people tend to, it's more accepted. They just rattle away. And
exactly. We just got, because the semester's just starting up at Pacific, first students arrive on Friday. And they always send out things that you have to have on your syllabus, like where if you have learning disabilities, that kind of stuff. But there's a new thing as of last year that says it is not acceptable to record anything in the classroom unless you ask for permission and get it. Just because, students will just press a button on their iPhone and record away.
Yeah, it's like I'm amazed at the way public officials from governors on down rattle away on their keyboards for email.
Yeah.
Now, when I was in the state government, first place we didn't have much in the way of email.
Right.
It was just beginning to catch on. But putting something in writing that we had any idea would be preserved indefinitely and viewed by others than the recipient at the time was something we were very careful about. Almost everything was done by word of mouth.
Yeah, yeah.
In our office.
Yeah. I find that I'm one of the few people that I work with that still does that. There are things that just shouldn't go into email. We can talk about them in person, and if they take a step further, then let's start documenting. But
I still meet with public officials active today because I'm part-time still on contract. They'll say that more often than not, it may be someone in the same physical office space, but they'll find themselves writing an email to the person because they know they're not going to have to go into that cubicle and stand and wait while the person gets off the phone or something.
Right. I was talking to some lobbyists who'd been around since the 1970s, and one of the things that Vic kept from all his years when he was in the legislature, he made scrapbooks for all of those years. And for the first two sessions, 1959 and 1961, he actually kept every single legislative note. And so that's where I found out that Monty Montgomery was pretty much a scumbag from the beginning. But I was telling that to the lobbyists, because for me it's just a gold mine, but it's just for two sessions. After that, he keeps them only if he wants to save them. And they were saying that for them now, it's harder to figure out what's going on the floor, because it used to be they could follow the pages and the notes. And now you can't because people are texting.
Yeah.
And so if you know you're watching for this one, that one, and that one, you can see if somebody texts and somebody responds. It's a much different...
Whole different thing.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm going to ask you a lot of questions.
Sure.
But let's start out with, so where did you first encounter Vicatea?
Okay, and I graduated from law school in 1958.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a, what I'd call a hiring recession among law firms back at East.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd always wanted to come out west. I'd never been west before. So I got a job through the employment office at the law school, and it was with legislative counsel's office. Sam Haley was
mm-hmm.
then the legislative counsel.
Mm-hmm.
He was my first boss, a professional boss. So I came out here, everything that I owned in the world with being in the trunk of my car,
mm-hmm.
and went to work for the legislative counsel's office, and it was in the during the 1959 legislative session that I first encountered Victor,
mm-hmm.
and he it wasn't a very extensive contact, and he was not by any means one of the leaders.
Right.
He was a freshman.
Yeah.
Himself.
Yeah.
Excuse me. So we both came to Oregon political lives at the same legislative session.
Yeah.
So I knew him, acquaintance, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
But that was about it.
Mm-hmm.
And and I can't remember now precisely when our paths crossed more markedly than that. But it was
it in the legislature?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it might have been he starts getting some chairmanships of committees
chairmanships
in the Senate?
Of committees, right. And more active in introducing legislation, which would mean he was dealing with legislative counsel on the drafting of measures.
Right.
One of the things I remember that he was not the leader, but he was active in promoting a sales tax.
Yeah.
And one of my assignments in the legislature, or a specialty, I guess I ought to say, was tax legislation.
Mm-hmm.
So
which is right up his alley, too.
Everybody who was anybody in the legislature then and who was interested in promoting a sales tax or indeed opposing a sales tax
mm-hmm.
Would come in for drafting of amendments to bills and
mm-hmm.
so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm. When you were dealing with him in the legislature, did you notice a difference between when he was becoming a more and more powerful senator, and then when he became the minority leader? Minority leader he becomes in 1971.
He seemed, my impression was he seemed more seasoned and mature.
Okay.
I'm trying to think of any specific examples, but
well, one thing that happens is he gets more and more chairmanships at that point, because
mm-hmm.
the old coalition is still alive in the Senate.
Yep.
But also, especially at 71, 73, they're doing okay, but 75, 77, they start running out of Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
All of a sudden, they were sitting on a lot of committees. And
they ran out of Republicans, yes. And the joke going around was that when he called caucus of the Republicans, they met in a phone booth.
Right. And Wally Carson gleefully showed me a picture of them in the phone booth.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah, Wally. I'd forgotten about Wally. Is he still living?
Yeah. I talked to him in February or March.
Oh, okay.
He was funny on the sales tax because, sales tax in Oregon, the Republicans would be in favor of sales tax or income tax and the Democrats the other way, and then they'd switch.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, Wally went up to visit people in the legislature in Olympia, and the parties were exactly the reversed.
Hmm.
And he thought, my, the water in the Columbia River is a very powerful thing.
Yes.
It just switches those parties around.
And let's see, he was, I didn't notice that he tended to promote more of a party loyalty than was commonplace in the time. There wasn't, it's hard to imagine such a thing nowadays, but when I first came out here, there wasn't a heck of a lot of difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. Republicans so generally were a little more pro-business, but not overboard.
Do you think that promoting of the party loyalty a little bit more was in reaction to the coalition, which was...
Can't say. I'd never considered that it was linked.
Because I know he hated the coalition, and then he became the minority leader, and all of a sudden he was sucked into working in the coalition.
He's a practical man.
Yeah, he was very practical.
He was not that one of the things, you know, here I find that I was his legal counsel, member of an intimate personal staff for 8 years, and ever since I first came to Oregon, I've been a registered Democrat. It didn't bother him at all. Things, until Neil came in, things pretty much functioned along the lines of personal loyalties. Whether you were associated with somebody either in their party or their entourage wasn't so important.
Talking to Pat Amadeo, she was sure that, well, Bob Duncan was sure that she wouldn't get the job. And then, poof, she got the job.
Party was it was important in terms of his peers, I guess, but not the staff. If you were personally loyal, and he never asked me to you know, to do something that he knew was contrary to my own personal conscience, so to speak. For example, he knew that my feeling was that if a woman has an abortion, that's her business and none of mine. So he never asked me, I have a conference, I have a scheduled appearance at a meeting of Oregon Right to Life, would you draft some appropriate response. No, he wouldn't do that.
So was he the first person that you worked in the executive for?
No. In 19, I'm getting fuzzy on dates, the first occasion was in the 60s when Tom McCall invited me to be his legal counsel. And let's see, that would have been... during the second year of his administration, when Ed Branchfield was appointed as a member of the Court of Appeals and opened up a vacancy there on his staff. I was on his staff for 6 years. And those were interesting days. Those were the days of Vortex. And that's all, that's nerve gas, all that stuff. And I had frequent contacts with Victor during those years. And by the way, that's when I learned that if somebody came up and said, I'm an old friend of Vic, Vic's my old friend, I need to talk to Vic, he'll be upset if you don't let me talk to him. We'd know they were phonies, because if you were an old friend of Vic, you knew that he preferred being called Victor. It was one of those screening devices. But anyway, going back, it was after 6 years on McCall's staff that McCall appointed me to the health division, and I was administrator in the health division for a couple of years. And then I was moved up to Deputy Director of Human Resources. Then they created a new agency, the Health Planning and Development Agency, which was an independent body. It was a think tank sort of thing. And I was made director of that. And it was then that I was made, that Victor invited me to be his legal counsel.
Legal counsel. So in McCall's office, you said you dealt with Victor a lot then. Was this basically, were you a go-between between McCall and Vic, or were you?
Sometimes, yes.
I mean, their relationship.
Their relationship was never, they were never bosom friends.
Yeah. Although, here's one thing I discovered, which is fascinating to me, from Vic's son. Tom McCall would come over for dinner occasionally to the house before McCall ran for governor, after Vic is elected. So there's some interesting growth there, because by the time we get to land use in 73, 74, they head back to D.C., and McCall says, I've never liked you anyway.
I wasn't privy to any of that. That's interesting.
Yeah. But it was, were you to go between on some things?
On some things. And I'd be hard put to give a specific example, but I do remember more than once. Victor said, that was when McCall referred to Tia and his wrecking crew.
Yeah.
And this was very upsetting to Victor.
Yeah.
And I wasn't working for him at the time, but he called me, he caught me in the hall and invited me into his office, which at that time was next to the men's room on the second floor of the Capitol. And he asked, what have I done there? What specific can you let me know? I said, I'm puzzled what he thinks I've wrecked. And I frankly told him I think it would be hard to finger any one particular thing. Is probably just a general feeling that you haven't been sufficiently supportive. So,
as you were working for McCall and then going into the bureaucracy and then coming out and working for Victor, several dynamics are going along. First of all, the Republican Party is being identified with Tom McCall, with Mark Hatfield, with Bob Packwood. And they're moderate to liberal.
Oh, they'd never get through with the Republican primary today.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, they'd be dead in the water at the start.
Oh, yeah, there's no way. And Victor would as well. Yeah. I don't think he would make it through.
No.
But it's a fascinating dynamic where Victor seems to be the conservative one, whereas as we get further away, it's like he's much closer to them. Just in perspective.
In perspective, yes. At the time, he was definitely viewed as a more conservative force than was either McCall or Packwood or any of these people that you named.
Did you pay any attention to the elections? Were you just watching them from afar? Your positions?
I was watching them closely. I didn't get drawn into the mechanics of the elections. From time to time, I'd get involved in peripheral matters, such as Ron Schmidt wanted to plant some letters to the editor by you know what I'm talking about. And I must have written, and I don't know, any number of drafts for people to sign and send in. And we used to say now, or Ron would tell them, that it's very important now, don't do this word for word. Scramble the language a little, put in your own words. Almost invariably, it would be word for word what would have written. They would just sign it, send it. But that's why I would look at letters to the editor today on behalf of candidates, and I can spot them right away.
Oh, yeah. I teach a class in elections where the students all have to go out and work in campaigns, and that's usually their first shred of innocence that's taken away. Okay, we want you to write letters to the editor.
But
it's like, you're not going to sign them, but you need to write them.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I would write on speeches.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I ever wrote a full speech, but I used to write sections of speeches.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in that case, usually the certainly McCall and I think Atiyah too, to a great extent, would reword them,
uh-huh.
go over them, and put their own flair on the language. But essentially, it was their speech, even though they had help.
Yeah. What was it like to work for McCall as a manager?
It was helpful not to take too seriously anything he said when he was upset and angry.
Mm-hmm.
Wait until the next day before taking action on
mm-hmm.
it. And because he was a very emotional person, much more emotion. I don't know whether it's fair to say he was more emotional than Atiyah, but certainly his emotions were expressed much more quickly and forcefully.
Mm-hmm.
So one learned not to carry out his instructions too soon. You know, no one rid me of this noxious.
Right. Right.
Priest.
Did you find that he was generating ideas, or he?
McCall, I don't know. You know, you picked, not all of them were original.
Uh-huh.
For example, during the energy shortage, he was credited with the odd even license plate thing. Wasn't his idea at all. It was the idea of Don Jarvie, who was mm-hmm. in the energy department then.
Mm-hmm.
And when when McCall got a briefing from the energy people on the progress of the energy remediation efforts, Jarvie said, you know, it'd be a good idea if somebody would mandate blah de blah. And McCall said, that's an excellent idea.
Mm-hmm.
Not his idea, but he had the good sense to seize on it
and
run with it.
Yeah.
Atiyah, he didn't have the personality or the fiscal resources to come up with as many innovations as McCall did, I think.
Yeah. After that, kind of the first 6 months of his 8 years, he's holding on for dear life with the economy.
It was awful.
Yeah.
And we all on the staff took serious pay cuts.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I was talking with John Juncker, and he was talking about being there with the agency heads and looking around saying, you're going to have to take serious pay cuts.
Yeah. And, you did it. And I don't know what would be done today, whether you'd have quite the same... I wouldn't say it was easy for
mm-hmm.
the governor to enforce it, but
mm-hmm.
people cooperated.
Yeah, absolutely. So when did he approach you about being his counsel?
We're talking now about Atiyah.
Yeah.
He didn't approach me directly. This is another thing that goes on in government to
mm-hmm.
avoid embarrassment. There's almost always an intermediary,
mm-hmm.
or the way it was then. His intermediary was Lee Johnson.
Uh-huh.
He had just appointed Lee to be his executive assistant.
Okay.
Put the staff together. Lee indicated that, and I'd say I had a working relationship many years with Lee
mm-hmm.
When I was in legislative council. I drafted a lot of stuff, and he had, like everybody else back then, had his own sales tax plan.
Right. Right.
Which I put together. So anyway, he gave me a call. I was then in the health planning agency directorship. He said, how about lunch? Okay, given the circumstances and the timing, it was obvious he wanted to propose some
right.
move.
Right.
So we had lunch that day. He said, the governor wants to appoint so-and-so as his legal counsel. I think that would be a bad choice. Can I tell him that you would accept an offer? And I said, sure.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even remember who the other guy was. It was a guy.
Mm-hmm.
No one whose name would be exciting to remember anyway.
Right, right.
At this point. So I was brought in and sat down with the governor, governor-elect.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I understand you would be interested in serving as counsel. And he didn't say my, I noticed this, he didn't say my legal counsel.
Mm-hmm.
He said, interested in serving as governor's legal counsel.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So that's when it took off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fascinating the way he
didn't carry an extensive review conversation or interview. He pretty much, I guess, knew just about all that he felt he needed to know.
Yeah.
I'd been around a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing how he was able to size people up and do that. And talking to his older brother, who was still alive, Vic was doing most of the hiring at the store for that same reason.
Mm-hmm.
He was really good at it.
Yeah.
And then he was kind of hands-off after that.
Mm-hmm.
But he was really the hiring guy.
Interesting. Oh. Yeah. Well, he just happened to have had some contacts, and I just happened to have had Lee as a friend who came in there.
So you're starting to work for the governor. Big issues. It's been described as the first kind of year and a half where Pat Amadeo's time, all those sorts of natural resource things, there's energy issues, mm-hmm. timber, all those, and then the economy just kind of sweeps all that aside.
Yeah.
Anything in that first term jump out, for instance, thinking about the kicker, thinking about there were huge refunds to taxpayers out of that first legislative session in 1979. Anything jump out?
Curiously enough, I wasn't involved deeply in the tax matters when I was on his staff.
Uh-huh.
I got involved in a lot of general administrative work. The land use had heated up quite a bit.
Yeah.
Pat and I were on the horn quite a bit on that. And she was, she actually promoted whatever we wanted promoted.
Mm-hmm.
But I was involved in checking out the legality of it. There were some tricky issues.
Yeah.
And let's see. That was, can't remember when it was. I was trying to think when the Rajneesh stuff.
That doesn't start until the second summer, 1981 in the summer to fall.
That's when I was, that was virtually my full-time preoccupation.
Yeah.
Along with Jerry Thompson, so that must have been during the second term.
Yeah, because Lee leaves at the beginning of September, she mm-hmm. comes in. The Rajneeshis have just arrived like in July.
Mm-hmm.
Of that year, so I have Rajneeshi questions.
Yeah, sure. I won't rush you on that one.
Yeah, so you're looking at land use stuff. You're doing the legality. So the whole, it's been described to me that land use was in place, but then there's, you know, the implementation of it basically takes all of Straub's time, and then Victor comes in and says, look, counties and cities, you have to get this damn thing done
mm-hmm.
so that we can, you know, go recruit businesses and there's certainty and all those kinds of things. Does that jive with what you...
Yeah, he was fine-tuning it to a great extent.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Polk County said, we are not going to mess around with this foolishness. Go jump in the lake.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. I said, all right, very well. There'll be what was called an enforcement order, which meant any building permits or whatever would be invalid.
Mm.
That attracted the attention of the Board of Commissioners.
I can imagine that it would.
And they complied.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a combination of using the power of the office when you need it and mm-hmm. cajoling and doing all those
and
things.
And what is ironic, if you look back in the past, is that in the early days of McCall, Hector McPherson, mm-hmm. all those people, when Senate Bill 100 first came along, land use planning was sold to the legislature and other interests as, how would I put it, a process in which the state would exercise general control over the details of land use planning, mm-hmm. but the actual implementation would be the primary responsibility of the local governments,
mm-hmm.
cities and counties, and that the goals were merely guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, as time went on, LCDC had got into the details more and more, and
yeah.
Oregon administrative rules expanded exponentially with respect to land use planning. And there was a tightening also of many of the standards. For example, early on, you could build a dwelling on farmland.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a requirement that the farm, quote farm, would have to generate X amount of dollars annually.
Right.
Okay, the X amount of dollars at the in the state level, which applied to counties, kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger as mm-hmm. time went on,
mm-hmm.
so that tons of acres of land, which were classed in counties as EFU, really were not, they would probably would not have been classed as EFU. They would have been put in some other classification, such as timber conservation mm-hmm. or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
If they had been originally going according to the standards that were coming out now.
Right.
It was kind of ex post facto, you know. You tell the counties, set aside what is going to be treated as sacred farmland according to these standards, but then as time goes on, you get the standards tighter and tighter.
Mm-hmm.
So, whoa, you know, that's not really EFU land. But, oh, yeah, it is. You said mm-hmm. it was going to be. And much of the zoning went on in an ad hoc way. I talked to people in Polk County, for example, to draw up their plan, their comprehensive plan, as they called it. They rented a office space outside the courthouse, hired some people temporarily, gave them a lot of aerial photos and soil maps and said, mm-hmm. okay, come up with a classification.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hastily done, sloppy, in effect. But that's what they got stuck with later. And, of course, those were the days when everything was comprehensive planning.
Mm-hmm.
You had a comprehensive health plan, a comprehensive land use plan,
mm-hmm.
comprehensive this and that plans. Which kind of illustrates how there are fads and fashions in the nomenclature of legislation.
Yep. My dad was elected county commissioner in Jackson County in 1974, and we had all these books from Germany on comprehensive planning.
Mm-hmm.
It was very fun.
Well, You know, they had a comprehensive health plan too,
which
I had something to do with.
Yeah. So was the ratcheting up of the requirements, did you see that as primarily from bureaucratic rules, or was this the legislature pushing
bureaucratic rules?
Bureaucratic rules?
Yeah.
So it's interpretation and...
Interpretation, yeah.
Okay.
Got stricter.
Yeah.
And it didn't obviously offend the majority of the legislators, because they could have acted to overrule that, but they didn't.
Fascinating. Were you involved in any of the negotiations or backing up people like Pat Amadeo as they were looking at things like Northwest Power Planning Council? Any of the big energy things that were going on in that first?
Not really.
Okay.
Not
okay.
really.
Yeah.
Not enough to talk about it.
Yeah. Yep. So let's move into 1979 ends, 1980 comes along, and the economy is starting to head south in a big way. Between the end of the legislative session and the end of the year in 1979, Paul Volcker raises interest rates by about 35-40%. So this is our first big recession in Vic's years. Little did we know a bigger one was coming along, 1982. Did you get a sense of the governor's office as in triage mode trying to deal with this stuff? Or is it, did you see more focus on the economy or balancing a budget that was being hit hard as income taxes were plummeting?
I think that serious consideration was given to the surtax, which would be unthinkable on the part of the no new taxes today.
Yeah.
So, but the main thrust was trimming the budget.
Okay.
That was the main thrust.
Yeah.
And I can remember we set up a schedule. I wasn't involved in this. Budget Bob Smith was the one who was coordinating it with, along with John Yunker.
Mm-hmm.
But they set up a series of interviews with agency heads, in which they were invited in to comment on proposals coming out of the executive department for trimming X percentage out of the budget for the agency. And it was a sad scene, people coming in, not quite on their knees, but pleading for this, that, and the other thing. And I remember when the State Health Planning and Development Agency came in, and what was his name? Anyway, the director of it at the time, my successor, said, "Can't you do something here, Bob? Can't you do something? You know, we're about to lose such and such a program. Doesn't matter what it was, such and such." I said, "Hey, you know, the governor's express." Demand is that this be on a straightforward basis. How much it was, I wouldn't guarantee, but that was the word.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a give-and-take political thing. So one of the requirements was that they lose a couple positions that they had at the time for continuing detailed drafting work on the comprehensive health care plan. And I remember I said, the program will struggle on without that. That's one of those things that would be nice, but maybe in better times. So down it went. And that was essentially... The process took about as long as it did the time, about the same as it took for me to tell you about it.
Yeah.
They're in a hurry.
Yeah.
So.
Let's move into 1981 and start dealing with the Rajneeshis. Rajneeshis arrive. They buy the property at the in June, basically. The Bhagwan arrives in July or early August and is somewhat shocked that it's a desert, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Stiles and Friends of Oregon gets involved pretty quickly because of Wasco County.
Yeah.
When did it first come to the governor's office in terms of kind of saying, huh, something's going on?
Can't give you an exact date, but Bob Logan was at the time local government mm-hmm. relations coordinator.
Mm-hmm.
And in the governor's staff meeting one day, when we held them weekly.
Yeah.
By agency. Bob said, and by the way, a bunch of foreigners from India are making plans to settle at the old Big Muddy Ranch. It was, you know, sort of so. And he said it's a potentially troublesome thing because they've got big, big bucks. And they have big, big plans to build a city there.
Mm-hmm.
And that attracted the attention of some of us. And we, you know, began to want to know more about it. And part of the materials I gave to the project
mm-hmm.
through Denny
mm-hmm.
were materials gathered by state police
mm-hmm.
from other agencies dealing with what was the name they called? The ashram.
Mm-hmm.
At Pune and other efforts they were perhaps instigating around the country. So it started out as casual almost mention.
Yeah.
I wish I could give you the date, but I did. When I worked for McCall, when I left that office, I once said, if I ever get another job like this, I am going to keep a daily journal. But I didn't.
Yeah, exactly.
You're too busy.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know how people like John Quincy Adams managed to keep daily diaries with all they did for their whole life.
And all the letters that he wrote.
Yeah.
I guess he didn't sleep.
I guess not.
Yeah.
Well, anyway. Anyway, that's about how it started.
Okay.
And we had a division of Penn. Pat was initially concerned about it. She was not taken in by the presentations. I was called, or I was invited by Bob Davis,
mm-hmm.
an old associate, who was then hired as a lobbyist by Rajneeshi to attend a briefing, and it was held at a restaurant in Salem. It's not there anymore. Doesn't matter. For lunch with a slideshow and all that. And that's where I met Jay and Ananda
mm-hmm.
and Sheila, who were introduced, and they told me all the wonderful things they wanted to do and would I communicate this to the governor, who had been invited but was much too busy to come. And I had a real spiel I always gave when I spoke, whether it was to an American Legion chapter on the 4th of July picnic or whatever. Governor Atiyah appreciated the invitation to appear at this meeting or mm-hmm. whatever. However, a prior commitment, he made it impossible for him to come You get the picture.
Yeah.
It was a spiel, and I had it at that time, too. So, I didn't like the sound of it either. That was true at the time, even more so in retrospect, of course. And most people who met them, they were pleasant enough, ingratiating almost, but the whole thing had a funny smell. Now, I don't know whether you mentioned that it came to the point where Jayananda and Sheila invited the governor and Dolores to come over and visit, stay overnight, tour the facilities, and so forth. Well, of course, the governor was much too busy to attend that. So I was invited, or directed, rather, to accept the invitation. And Judy agreed to go with me. And I had a funny, creepy feeling that it would be a good idea to have a wife along. And we went there and were put up overnight and had a luxurious meal with lots of devotees. And we toured the facility and saw all that was going on. Came back, I wrote a report on it, which was in the materials that I contributed. And by the way, a lot of the stuff that I contributed to the archive could have been considered a violation of the attorney-client privilege if I had turned right around and let people see it. But by the time the archive was being constructed at the university, of course, even more so now, there is no such relationship anymore, except as it might embarrass some people to have it known.
There are kind of a series of crises in that first year. In the spring, well, in the winter, we figure out that they want to have the first of their annual Rajneesh Beans. And at the same time, they're moving into Antelope because they, in effect, they find out about our land use laws. And so their meetings, and it's, you have a great report of going to one of those meetings where Bob Davis tells you about being threatened by the Antelope people. At some point, and I think it's in 1984-85, there start being daily and weekly meetings focusing on
the task force.
In 1982, was this basically your bailiwick at that point?
I would say that I was one of my formal titles of public safety coordinator, which included state police, National Guard, and emergency management. So, you know, I was deeply involved in it. And the there was a lot of times that it got beyond which guard units would be alerted. Jayananda, at one point, and Sheila was on his, sitting with him, as always, in my office, and said, you know, what would the governor think if we agreed to give up Rajneeshpuram, to pull out of, not Rajneeshpuram, Antelope, if we agreed to pull back on Antelope and hands off the Wasco County commissioners. And I said, I'm not optimistic, but I will find out. And again, my advice to the governor was, don't do it. But I didn't need to really stress it too much because he was not agreeable to it.
Yeah, he's not a big bargainer.
So I got back to them and told them, no go.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know whether that was ever public or not.
Uh-huh.
And we knew they had some pretty nasty weapons.
When did you first become aware of that? And was it, do you remember if it was intelligence that you guys had, or was it the ATF coming in and saying, look, we've got reports they're going to try to buy, or they tried to buy?
Do not remember.
Okay.
I don't remember.
Because it's the weapons really don't take off. It seems like the end of 82, because coming out of that first 1982 gathering is when they have their private security.
Mm-hmm.
Which I found fascinating. Wasco County basically forced them to have that.
Mm-hmm.
That it developed into this almost a mini army. But it's kind of by the end of 82, 83, they seem to be seriously amassing weaponry.
Yeah, and at one point a member of the staff had prepared some Q&A briefing paper.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was the question, what about reports that they have machine guns? And so I didn't know of any such reports that they have machine guns. Maybe I was being too literal.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, I don't think they have machine guns, really. And that went into the paper, and it was wrong, because not long after that we saw a film taken of one of the parades of the Bhagwan.
Mm-hmm.
Driving in his Cadillac, and the security was armed with semi-automatic weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Which was awkward.
Yeah, absolutely. The governor really thought of the Rajneeshis in several ways, but first, he was not ever going to have a face-to-face meeting with them. Secondly, it was really important that the law be applied equally.
Mm-hmm.
That law applied equally was a real stress point. You know, people wanted the Rajneeshis responded to or kicked out.
Do something, Governor. Do something.
Yeah.
We've heard that frequently. Do something. And eventually something was done through the land use law process.
Right.
And in cahoots with the immigration agency. But what does one do without being a dictator,
right,
or a tyrant? He felt, and I think we all did, that on the staff anyway, that we had to carefully follow the law so that we wouldn't be charged with violating them of their civil rights.
Mm-hmm.
It was goes back. Same thing was happening back at the under McCall. Time of Vortex and all that.
Mm-hmm.
When there were student demonstrations on the campuses and the streets, and a lot of people were demanding that McCall do something to put an end to this.
Mm-hmm.
The extremist comments ranged all the way up to issue live ammunition to the National Guard and send them in there to disperse the demonstrators.
Mm-hmm.
This is right after Kent State.
Right.
And, of course, McCall wouldn't go along with that.
Yeah.
And Attila wouldn't go along with use of force. When we did put out the word to through General Miller to the guard, keep track of your people on the weekends, mm-hmm. where they are, mm-hmm. And make sure that all the personnel have contact information with their local units, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. to say that we had ordered a ring of steel around Rajneeshpuram was an exaggeration.
Right.
But they were on alert.
Yeah. In 1985, the guard goes on maneuvers in Klarno. Mm-hmm. Was that, I haven't really found any news coverage that points that out or anything. Was that known at the time?
On maneuvers?
Yeah.
There may have been. I don't know. It was not something certainly that any scheme that was hatched in our office.
Mm-hmm.
But the guard might have organized something along those lines, mm-hmm. On its own, which would have been okay.
Mm-hmm. In 1983, Dave Frohnmayer challenges Rajneeshpuram on the basis of religious grounds.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in October, basically. And in November, it becomes clear that what this means is the state isn't going to release money that it releases to other cities for 911 and all that, mm-hmm. kind of stuff. Were you privy to where that decision was made about the state money going or not going to Rajneeshpuram?
I have a recollection of sitting in a briefing when I think Jerry Thompson was with me. We were advised of what Frohnmayer was, mm-hmm. preparing to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's my recollection of it. It was not something we exactly hammered out together, but it was brought,
mm-hmm.
for comment.
So nothing from that to the decision not to release money to them?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. There's an intriguing memo that you wrote the next spring where actually somebody writes in about the automatic weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And you write back and say, look, police forces in Oregon can have automatic weapons. As far as I can tell, none of the other ones do, but, you know, they're within their rights. But you also say in that letter, you say, even though they're being challenged, until that challenge is complete, they are following the rules,
mm-hmm.
set up but for cities, which to me seems like the opposite way of the don't give them any money argument.
No, I think there was a distinction. On the one hand, there is a pretty specific provision in the federal, it's in the Federal Bill of Rights, but it's applicable to the states, and there's comparable language in the Oregon Constitution. Money may not be appropriated for a religious institution.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it doesn't say a religious institution is limited in what weapons its security people can carry. We're drawing a distinction. There was a specific language on support of religious facilities.
Right.
The other was, you have to go through a lot of inferences.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I can see why, on the face of it, you might think, well, that's a little inconsistent. And perhaps in the impact it's inconsistent. But we were treading carefully on civil rights issues.
Yeah, absolutely. Were you involved in when KD became an informant?
No.
That's basically, mm-hmm. Jerry.
Didn't. I wasn't surprised, but yeah. I remember when Jerry and I went to Portland and we met in the evening in a hotel meeting room up there with Sheila. And KD, I don't know whether Jay Ananda was. I don't think Jay Ananda was there. I think he was in retrospect, he was being maneuvered out or something. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't there. And it was kind of a... they had wanted us to come over there for dinner, and we were reluctant to do that because there were some who felt that Sheila was playing the part of Lucretia Borgia at the time. Mm-hmm. So we met there, and it was not for dinner. It was just a meeting in it. And KD was kind of leading the discussion on behalf of the Rajneesh, making proposals for this and that, and I'm hard put now to remember exactly mm-hmm. what they were. But Sheila apparently got very impatient and almost as if pounding the table, well, she wasn't doing that exactly, said, these were all details. What we are demanding is that Governor Atiyah come to Rajneesh and welcome us to Oregon. At which point Jerry said, I can tell you right now, you will not do that. So Sheila stood up and said, but then I think our discussion's at an end. And I happened to be looking at KD at the time, and he was, as nearly as I can recall, he had a pencil in this hand and a sheet of paper, and he put the pencil down and did like that and mm-hmm. shook his head as if, mm-hmm. how can I do anything with this mad woman in charge?
Mm-hmm.
And it was later I learned that he had become an informant.
Yeah.
I liked KD.
Uh-huh.
Seemed very practical person.
Mm-hmm. Kind of fascinating that on many of the documents, especially for the first couple of years, they would sign it with their Rajneesh name and then in parentheses, AKA,
mm-hmm.
with their real names. And then that changes mm-hmm. as AKAs go away. As we're getting to the end of the Rajneesh time, do you remember when the possibility of poisonings began?
You know, we heard that the DA for
there's the county commissioners,
the salads at lunches.
Yeah, the Dallas.
Yeah,
84.
And at first, we had a tendency to disbelieve that. I know because it didn't make sense.
Yeah.
To go around poisoning the public and when in secrecy. it would be akin nowadays, of course, to terrorists throwing a bomb, but no terrorist organization would claim responsibility.
Right.
Why was the bomb thrown at the wedding?
Yeah.
And at first we disbelieved it. Then somebody poisoned Mike Sullivan's coffee.
Mm-hmm.
We began to wonder if maybe something was amiss there.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike Sullivan was DA at the time.
Yeah, Jefferson County.
So it was hard to prove.
Yeah, yeah.
Hard to prove. So it was still an open question, as I remember.
Yeah.
We couldn't deny it.
Yeah. Yep. Do you remember when there was first a big concern about electronic eavesdropping? Was that after Sheila left and it was discovered on the ranch, or before?
No, when Jody and I went over there, as she could tell you. We had a nice bedroom
mm-hmm.
provided, and I had told her in advance, now remember, everything we say very likely will be heard, if not recorded. And we assumed we were bugged.
Mm-hmm.
So we said nothing except inane comments about the food that she on Sheila's table. And let's see. It seems to me later that Lon Holbrook,
mm-hmm.
state police aide,
mm-hmm.
was involved in examining the tapes they discovered. This was after the mm-hmm. thing collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
And Lon came up one day and said, "You and Judy sure have boring conversations."
That's wonderful.
I said, "Designedly so."
Yep, yep.
And I'm sure that if I had gone over there without her, then, well, I just didn't want to do it. Because I'm sure I would bet anything that some bosomy
mm-hmm.
chambermaid would have come in and asked me if there was anything she could do to help.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't happen.
No. Yeah.
It's my imagination, fevered imagination.
With Rajneesh's collapse, there's a period of about a month between when Sheila leaves and then the Bhagwan leaves.
Oh.
Were you part of the meetings that Jerry was having with the various and sundry players
going on? I'm not sure that I was.
Okay.
Not, I mean, my involvement kind of slacked off once things calmed down, once mm-hmm. Sheila departed,
mm-hmm.
things say there wasn't any more drum beating over there.
Yeah, yeah. So it was fairly quickly towards an end, although the governor was over in Taiwan and had to talk in code because they didn't know if they were being taped.
Yeah.
Danny says it was a pretty stupid code, but.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, we all talked in code. Actually,
yeah.
Outside our own office,
yeah.
Which had been swept, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Vern Duncan says that his office was swept as well. So, amazing times.
Yes.
Let's go back to before the Rajneeshis. Talk to me about the rise and fall of Lee Johnson.
Oh. Well, okay, insofar as when you, how far back you want me to go?
Well, that's just as him as executive assistant.
Just as executive
assistant. Just as executive assistant. Discovering Jerry was always the governor's first choice, and then Lynn Newbery was second, and then it's unclear.
Oh, that's interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah, there's all sorts of fun things come up, and then somewhere. It's Lee Johnson was not third or fourth, so he was down there somewhere. But he comes in.
No, it surprised me because he was on the Court of Appeals at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Although later on, I remember saying, that sure was a boring job. He said, the cases all looked alike, and about the only phone call I ever got was from my wife.
Yep. Yeah, when he died, Victor said about him that... he was much happier on the Multnomah County Circuit Court because he basically got to do stuff.
Yeah, right. Anyway, okay, I interrupted.
But it's been described as fairly early on it became clear that this was not going to be a match that
yeah.
worked out.
Yeah. Trying to think of any specific example.
Well, there was, for instance, there was the Woods nomination.
Kelly Woods.
Yeah.
For energy.
For energy,
yeah.
And that's been described by reporters as the governor's office almost threatening people in the Senate, and then tracking down the reporters is like, yeah, that was Lee Johnson doing that.
That would have been Pat's bag of tricks. So I wasn't involved.
Yeah. 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 But from your point of view, did you see things begin to change between them, or never gel, or
again, it's hard to be anecdotal, but I I seem to recall a couple of occasions when I would be, when Lee was not present and I was with the governor, and mm-hmm. he would say something like, of course, Johnson's going to be unhappy about this, mm-hmm. or something like that,
mm-hmm.
or maybe Lee can deal with it, but I doubt it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it was more very subtle
yeah.
comments that made me think that there was a chink in the armor of the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When Jerry comes in, does the tenor of the office change because she's there, or is it just a new person?
No, I can't say that there was a big deal change in the office. In fact, Betty Maudlin went right on, took it in stride.
Mm-hmm.
Although she came to despise Jerry later towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
Betty's, of course, dead now.
Mm-hmm.
Illuminate that. But and so is Lee. But no, I don't think it was not as if there'd been a great breath of fresh air or
mm-hmm.
anything like that. No,
mm-hmm.
it was just, well, we got a new assistant in there, and curiosity of how to deal with him. And I never had anything trouble dealing with him, but we had an ongoing relationship beforehand.
Right.
So others might have.
Yeah. On the staff in 82, Denny leaves, Dave Fiscombe comes in, Denny goes and runs the campaign. Several people have talked about that it was their impression that Denny would not come back.
There was a feeling that that possibility existed, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Denny is alive, so I have to be tread careful here. It was my feeling that Jerry was not as comfortable with Denny as she might have been.
Mm-hmm.
And whether she was conspiring to... made the remark when there was a vacancy in the emergency management division leadership that she wondered if Denny would feel more comfortable in that job than what he's doing now.
Mm-hmm.
Just a casual remark,
mm-hmm.
which I didn't care to get involved in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, I was not involved in any discussion straightforwardly indicating whether there was efforts or desires to initiate efforts to get rid of Denny. But I do know that Jerry was not outspokenly supportive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And now they live a frisbee throw from each other.
Pardon, sorry.
They live a frisbee throw from each other.
Yeah.
Which is funny.
Yeah.
Talk to me about Victor as a manager. The Lee Johnson situation shows up in other places, in the store and other things. He's not very good at firing people.
No. Although he did fire some people when he had to. He, one thing that Lee told me when when he was talking to me about joining the office, he
mm-hmm.
said, "Now the governor wants a Boy Scout administration." And he said, "It's not going to be a place for hanky-panky." And I said, it's not as if he was saying, I expect you to do that, but, you know, he just said that we're going to have to be on our toes. And there was, within the first month or two of the administration, the governor's state police assigned bodyguard and driver messed around with the governor's number one limousine. Not the governor's, but I mean the office's number one limousine, using it to take his girlfriend out on dates and so forth. And when this came to Victor's attention, that guy was out of there.
Yeah.
Made his head spin. Then there was a guy who was hired, a guy who was hired as a typist. And what was his name? Roger something or other. And he made a pass at Carol Whitney. Phew, out of there. And I can think of at least two people.
Yeah.
And he did not let them down easy, as is often done. I didn't see any evidence that he was deeply concerned about personal lives outside the office, as long as it was discreet. There were firings.
And he, before, when his transition, he had a similar short conversation with Dan Goley, who was running economic development. He didn't even make it.
I remember Dan.
But that was quick and he was gone.
Well, if it was in the office,
yeah.
I mean, two people, a person might engage in some discreet behavior out of the office and with someone who was not either in the office or in chain of command. No, that was a flagrant.
What kind of direction did he give you? Basically, tell me what a legislative council does under ATIA, and maybe even compare it to under McCall. But what kind of direction did he give you in your job?
General direction.
Mm-hmm.
General direction. Get it done. For example, a bill, for example, having to do with appointment of judges. This is what he wanted. He wanted it to, he wanted it passed and touch base with so and so and so and so and so and so. Don't waste your time with such and such a person. And that was it. You were on your own then.
So using his legislative expertise of knowing the people.
Yeah.
And then saying, go figure it out.
Yeah, that was essentially it.
Okay.
He, I was present when he was having a lunch discussion with the president of Burlington Northern Railroad. And they both, at least verbally for each other, at the time said their philosophy of management was get a person that you believe is capable, tell them what your the end result you desire is, and keep your hands off. And I think generally that was about the way he went.
Switching to things Rajneeshis but shorter. Were you involved with the Bob Montgomery situation?
With the what?
Bob Montgomery.
Well, I knew that Bob did not share the view that Jerry and I had. I think Bob was much more willing to seek some kind of accommodation with the Rajneesh.
Mm-hmm.
That's about the extent that I was involved. I knew that he was soft.
Yeah.
On the Rajneesh.
Yeah.
But I wasn't involved in any machinations.
Right.
About him.
Were there conversations like that within the governor's staff that was dealing with the Rajneeshis about clamping down versus more of a soft approach?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Pat and I generally agreed that they were not to be trusted, although, you know, sometimes she and I would get into philosophical reflection that was not so much an expression of opinion mm-hmm. as an observation, and I can recall my saying it's sad that a group such as this, which has made the desert bloom,
mm-hmm.
And they did.
Oh yeah.
Should be regarded as a alien virus in their midst. But that didn't mean that I would embrace them.
Mm-hmm.
So we agreed they made the desert bloom.
Right. Absolutely. And grew microbes in it as well.
But I also realized there were people who did not want the desert to bloom for one reason or another.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Moving towards the end of the governor's term, you become the chief of staff for the last couple of months.
Oh, yeah. Caretaker job.
Caretaker job.
Mm-hmm.
So were you working with the transition team to Goldschmidt?
No.
At that point?
No. No, we were not approached.
Oh.
Neil brought a whole different, and I know you're not here to talk about Neil.
Well, but I'd like to hear people's impressions of the different governors,
because
Victor's part of there's a continuum here that goes on. So.
Yeah, Neil was a new element and took a new approach to Oregon state government. Under Hatfield, under Straub, under McCall, and under Atiyah, there was a professional cadre mm-hmm. of people in government in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
John Yonker was coming to be regarded as one of them. Who was?
Dan Simmons is in there?
Yeah. Fred Miller.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Penwell. Clayton Penwell.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Went on and on, you know. They were political, but they weren't specifically any one candidate or something. They sort of would take the attitude of, I serve the governor, whoever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
Neil came along, and that was not his something that he would not endorse.
Mm-hmm.
He would demand that I serve Neil Goldschmidt, as demonstrated by past loyalties and actions and so forth. Professional loyalty was something he didn't accept.
Mm-hmm.
He also, the only office he had held above mayor was a federal position,
yeah.
and he brought a lot of federal practices in with him. For example, the letter of resignation, which he insisted everybody submit a letter of resignation, which would be either returned unaccepted or accepted and bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.
This had never been the practice before. When a new governor came in, if you were on his personal staff, you assumed that he would want someone else. But mm-hmm. below that, you know, minor agencies and deputy directors and so forth and so on, you stayed in place unless asked to depart,
mm-hmm.
in which case you were simply terminated. There wasn't any requirement of a resignation.
Mm-hmm.
You were terminated. You left and were terminated. But I think part of it, of course, was by submitting a letter of resignation, you're cutting yourself off from unemployment benefits.
Yeah.
So it had that practical purpose.
Yeah.
But also, it was a symbolic act that if you had resigned and your resignation had not been accepted, then in effect, you were an appointment of Goldschmidt, an appointee of Goldschmidt.
Mm-hmm.
And there was he ran on the platform of getting rid of the deadwood, and just about everybody.
Infuriated Vic.
Was deadwood.
Yeah.
And that's when I got swept out, because mm-hmm. I was deadwood.
Yeah.
I was served under the wrong people.
Yeah.
So that was the end of the old regime. I don't know how things are now.
Yeah. It's been described that under Neil, he greatly expanded, in effect, the governor's personal staff. Although in the numbers, it turns out it's not that big of an expansion, but it's in agencies now had a political person from the governor's office kind of assigned to the major agencies.
A commissar.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly,
yeah.
exactly. Whereas under the old system, it's very much like the British parliamentary system, where there's a permanent secretary who's the bureaucracy, who's there.
It had a flavor of that.
To be there. Yeah, and so you have the expertise. And
You could make a career of it.
Yeah.
You kept your nose clean.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that was that Neil ended that.
Yeah, yeah. A funny story as well, the day after Neil was inaugurated, no one had a key to the governor's office. They couldn't get in. Jill Thorne, who had worked in the, you know, around the Capitol forever,
mm-hmm.
knew kind of where to go to get a key. Mm-hmm. But then when they got inside, they had no idea where the light switches were.
Mm-hmm.
So just a transition that was on its own and didn't really...
Well, you know, if they wanted to, if one of them had appeared,
mm-hmm.
said the governor would like to know something about what's going on in the office here, and how things work, and where the light switches are.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
certainly, but we figured they would come at an appropriate time if they were interested.
Yeah, yep. Victor lives for a long time after he's governor.
Yeah.
Talk to me about your impressions of him as an ex-governor.
Didn't have much contact with him as an ex-governor.
Mm-hmm.
We had from time to time, it wasn't annual, but we would have a reunion of all the staff members.
Mm-hmm.
He kept in touch, and about 3 years ago, there was out at Illa, Denny organized a big deal reunion.
Mm-hmm.
Victor was there, and Dolores. And, I didn't have occasion, being out of state government, really, to
mm-hmm.
have much dealings with him.
Mm-hmm.
So, but he... One thing that some people have asked me, why didn't the governor appoint you as a judge before he left office?
Mm-hmm.
And he had thought he had things all set up to do that, and then the judge whose vacancy I was to fill decided not to retire after all. So,
yeah,
that was the reason. Jerry tells the story that she said, "You really ought to appoint Judge Bob as a judge." And he said, "I don't think I can do without him right now."
Yeah.
Whether Jerry was trying to flatter me or whether that's the truth, right. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. So what's your overall impression of him as governor? And what I'm asking is, at the time, you're inside, you're watching things. So, for instance, the Rajneeshis, the vast majority of Oregonians thought he wasn't doing anything.
We were working our butts off.
But it's you know, the duck. Your feet are going like this, and on top it's...
Yeah.
So how come the governor isn't doing anything?
Yeah.
But then as time goes on, and people look back at the way that the recession was dealt with, the growth of the high-tech business sector, mm-hmm. You know, people are looking back and saying, wow, this is a pivotal person mm-hmm. in all of this. So what are your overall impressions of him as a governor?
Well, he was not as creative a person as McCall. Mm-hmm. Clearly, McCall was a fountainhead of ideas, mm-hmm. some of which were his own, some of which he stole from other people. But mm-hmm. I mean, point was, he embraced it. Victor's motto, I think, was, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Mm-hmm.
That's mm-hmm. about it. He did not embark on big reorganizations of government or constitutional revision efforts mm-hmm. or anything of that sort. He regarded himself as a steward to keep the ship running.
Mm-hmm. And doing a lot of bailing because the economy was...
Yeah.
Flooding the below decks.
And he made his mistakes. Made an ill-advised executive clemency move.
Right. The Dwayne Samples.
Yes. And by ill-advised, that gives you a clue as to what his staff felt.
Yeah. Well, Denny's pretty damn clear on it.
Yeah, and
did he go against the advice of staff?
Yes, absolutely.
Totally.
Yeah. And it was a sad episode.
Mm-hmm.
Personally embarrassing to me because there were rumors that I had slept with Sampras' wife in order to encourage him to give executive clemency.
Mm-hmm.
Had to pass a lie detector test and investigation. Fortunately, the lady herself said no such thing.
Mm-hmm.
Got started with the editor of a Silverton Weekly newspaper.
Mm-hmm. Who was doing the lie detector test? Was that independent or was that state police? State police.
Yeah. Mm. But that was Victor. We all screw up now and then, I guess.
Yeah. It's been described to me, and it fits with everything that I found out so far. He would make mistakes, and sometimes big mistakes, but he'd never make them again.
That's right, and he would never blame it on staff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was... Suppose I'd say I've had many bosses in my life. He was the one that I felt most comfortable working for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And was that because of the freedom to carry out things?
Well, that, yes.
Personality?
The personality, the uh-huh. freedom, the trust.
Yeah.
The fact that he knew, for example, that I disagreed with him on many political philosophies
mm-hmm.
points, but it didn't matter as long as it didn't interfere with
yeah.
the job. do. I was not a mole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's funny stories from Denny about trying to figure out who was leaking things sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think we knew who was doing most of the leaking.
Uh-huh.
And Denny did a little disinformation exercise on
yes.
that.
Identify clearly who it is, and off we go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So any last things?
No. Nope, I think that's about all that I was going to
okay.
would say.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, good.
It's been wonderful. Hour and 35 minutes.